Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to have you tuned in. Welcome to the program. I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Ross at the controls, Carissa's at the phones, and we're going to open our phones right away on the show today because the doctor is in. I always love programs like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, get some questions answered, maybe lingering health issues, whatever you have.
We're going to focus, at least starting out, on kids because it's back to school time, and I don't know if your kids, they're probably kind of past that age where they bring home all the germs that they picked up in the first few weeks
or so. Sometimes, yeah, mostly. I mean, they do have their immunizations up to date, so that helps.
It's that time of year where, you know, they maybe heading back into daycare or school, and suddenly you find the whole family has got another round of something.
That's right.
Thank you to, you know, some child who will remain nameless, I'm sure. Right? Well, we're going to talk today with a pediatrician and internal medicine specialist, Dr. Julie Stewart. We've had Julie on in the past, and thought it'd be a good time to just talk about good health and well-being and get to some of those things. So we'll talk immunizations and, you know, maybe some things about, you know, snacks and newborn care and all sorts of things. But the phone lines are open at 877-933-2484. So if you want to join in with us, if you have a question, you're welcome to call in. Julie Stewart, again, board certified in internal medicine and pediatrics and currently practicing at Community Health Center of Southeast Kansas in Pittsburgh, Kansas. It's the largest community health center in the state of Kansas, and she's the medical director of the Addiction Treatment Service at Community Health Center, implementing medication-assisted therapy for patients dealing with addiction, and uses her passion for holistic medicine as the physician champion for her organization's integration of primary and behavioral health care, including implementation of the behavioral health consultant model at Pittsburgh Clinic. We're grateful to have her back, and she's not too many months into being a new mom herself. So congratulations, Julie. Welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Oh, thank you so much, Neil. Good afternoon to your listeners.
Well, we figured that, you know, since you have a new baby around the house, that you could tell us all about, you know, baby care and all the things that you wish your pediatrician had told you. And we'll see if, you know, we'll get the information right. This is, you know, we kind of joke about it's the time of year kids going back to school. Does that mean that sickness is going to naturally follow? I mean, do the shared germs thing happening even as we speak?
It does. We absolutely know it does, and we see it as our clinic numbers swell every August and September.
And is it just because it's just kids together, or is it, I mean, are there some? I guess the question is, are there some things we could do to keep these shared germs and viruses at a minimum?
Well, you know, they're always around us, and so we can do our best and just know that sometimes things are going to come along. I know that we often deal with a rash of strep throat. We'll go around, and so we're handing out penicillin shots or, you know, antibiotics from that perspective. Viruses, just in general, kind of the upper respiratory things that we see with the cold, cough, runny nose, those will kind of go around. You know, it's interesting. God made our bodies so that we can fight off some viruses. We can get them once, and then once we have them, we're done for a lifetime. Other ones, we can get reinfected over and over. So the key is always going to be good hand washing, good hand hygiene. And then we used to teach our kids to cough or sneeze into their hands, cover their mouth when they cough, that kind of thing. But what we're actually doing now is teaching them to cough into their elbow, into their sleeve, so that their hands aren't getting the primary force of the germs, and that they're actually winding up on the sleeve, since the kids are much more likely to change their fingertips and change germs that way.
Sure. And how long are, you know, germs going to hang on our hands? I mean, if we, you know, if so, if even if we're, what, opening a door or something? I mean, is it, you know, on all day so we can be sure that by the time we get home they're still ready to be shared with others?
Hours and hours. And any mom who's sent their kid to preschool and picked them up at 5 o'clock, knows that, that wakes up with a runny nose herself the next day. So yes, they can be on our hands and skin on our bodies for hours, and they can be on surfaces up to days. You know, some cold viruses will last up to 2 weeks on just a kitchen countertop. So that's why we just really want to make sure that we're using hand sanitizer and certainly teaching our children to wash after they go to the bathroom. Because there are certain viruses that's how they spread is what's called the oral fecal route, and that is that when we eliminate and don't wash our hands, we can then ingest a virus or give it to someone else. So we got to watch that one too.
Well, so, you know, speaking of hand sanitizers and things, I mean, it seems like there's some talk about, well, maybe we're being too sanitary with those things, that we're, you know, these things are washing off the good antibiotics as well as the bad. Are they that we're cleaning ourselves too much, maybe?
Too much. You know, it's, as with all things, there's a balance. And, you know, I tell parents that the hand sanitizer, it's a good thing. Washing the carts off before you go into the grocery store or into Walmart, Target, that kind of thing. You use those wipes that are available to you because you don't know where that cart has been and what's been going on. We still encourage our, we live on a ranch in Kansas, and so we're around our cattle and our horses and that kind of thing, and we let the baby certainly play with his pony and that kind of thing. So we don't discourage active play, but then when they come in before they eat, they do need to be washing their hands, and that's certainly what we teach our little boy Corbin when he comes in from feeding his pony.
Mm. And so it's probably washing more than what we normally do. I suppose it's kind of like brushing our teeth. We probably don't do it as long enough to really be as effective as it could be.
Right. And I think that some parents are, you know, we get busy as parents with work and kids and school and getting to the extracurricular activities that we're not always intentional about making sure that our children have washed their hands when they come back from the restroom. But we really need to zero in on that. And the other thing is making sure that they're doing the cover and cough. And as, you know, allergies and cold viruses are coming around, that we're teaching them to cough into their elbow. Those are, if parents could just really work on those two things, I think we would see a lot less spread of germs, and we wouldn't have to worry quite so much about, you know, making sure they use the hand sanitizer just because they're getting picked up from school and they have to use the hand sanitizer in the car before they go home.
So mostly probably early on, it's what upper respiratory things that get spread around, right? Just the colds and things. Are there ways to minimize the length of those stays when those germs come to visit?
Oh, that is something that doctors have been trying to do for years. And we wish that, you know, I always tell parents, if you've got strep throat, that's good and bad. It's bad because it's strep throat and it's terribly uncomfortable. It's good because I have an antibiotic and I can fix it. Those upper respiratory infections and those cold viruses, they just have to run their course. And so really what we do is what's called supportive care, you know, using a cool mist humidifier in the children's rooms, lots of hand washing. Other than that, there's really not a magic pill that we can do to make the cold virus go away. So it's just tincture of thyme and good supportive care, Tylenol or, you know, ibuprofen for the kids if there's a fever and they're uncomfortable.
Wow, I was hoping, Julie, that you'd have a better answer than that. But I guess that's that's the reality of it, isn't it? If we're getting something that's going to run its course, there's no way around it.
Patience. It's just patience sometimes.
You know, speaking of antibiotics, do you get concerned sometimes? Or, I mean, we also hear reports about that. You know, we overuse. They're too readily prescribed. Are there some downsides to using antibiotics?
There are. And certainly, you know, even as physicians and in the medical community, we're trying to find out what the balance is, but there are lots of what we call superbugs and bacteria that are becoming resistant to the antibiotics we have. You know, I have a lady in hospital right now that we've had to keep in hospital the full 7-day course of her antibiotics, not because she wasn't ready to go home on Monday, but because she had to get an IV antibiotics through her veins because there were no oral medications that we could give her to fix her urinary tract infection. So that is a very real concern for us. And so, you know, even our little guys, when they come in with ear infections and mom's, you know, or the cold virus, if an antibiotic is indicated, then yes, we want the provider to prescribe that, but we also know that, you know, the side effects of the diarrhea that it can cause, the Clostridium difficile, the C. diff, which is a very bad bacteria that even children are getting because of overuse of antibiotics. So we want to be cautious, we want to do supportive care where we can, and we want to use antibiotics only when needed.
Dr. Julie Stewart is with us today, and she's a pediatric specialist, a pediatrician serving in Pittsburgh, Kansas at the Community Health Center, Southeast Kansas. And she's with us for the hour, and so we're opening up our phone lines to take your medical questions today. And maybe it has to do with, you know, helping your kids stay healthy, or it's something you've been wondering about. We've got some great opportunities to get some good health advice today, and we'll get into things like, you know, maybe early childhood concerns, newborn care, maybe even advances in medicines and diseases, those kinds of things. We'll tackle it all. Phone lines are open at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Dr. Julie Stewart, pediatrician, with us today. It's Ask the Pediatrician on Connecting Faith. Past the hour today, our phone lines are open at 877-93-FAITH, talking with Dr. Julie Stewart today. She's board-certified in internal medicine and pediatrics and serves at the Community Health Center at Southeast Kansas in Pittsburgh, Kansas. She's part of the Christian Medical and Dental Association and has worked with the Global Health Outreach in Honduras prior to entering medical school. Appreciate her insight today, and we're taking your questions as well. Julie, I did want to talk a little bit about vaccinations, and, you know, that's always seems like kind of an interesting topic. Are the rates dropping, and does that create concerns maybe for fall flu season or even other long-term concerns?
Well, Neil, vaccination rates are actually up across the United States. One of our big concerns, though, is with the flu vaccine. We continue to struggle as the medical community to convince or educate parents that the flu vaccine really does help children and protect them from the morbidity, the illness, and mortality leading up to the death of infants. When it comes to the flu virus, we do want them to get vaccinated.
And is there, you had a little baby not too long ago, so are shot schedules still the same as they were maybe a decade or two ago in terms of newborn care, and are they the same kinds of shots?
Well, we had the nasal flu vaccine a few years ago, and the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, actually, you know, came out and said maybe that one's not working as well, and I think that maybe dampened parents' hope that the flu vaccine is important to get, but there's still the injection form, and we do want parents to get that. Those usually come out. We've already got them in our clinic, usually around in September, and they're available. So anytime through the flu season, it's a good time to get your flu vaccine. As far as the general immunization schedule, one of the newer recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics and some other medical bodies is saying that the hepatitis B vaccine should be given before a baby even leaves the hospital, if at all possible. We used to say, you know, before their first well-child checkup, but we really want them to get that within the first 24 hours of life if they're born and they're above 4 pounds and 6 ounces.
And what is hepatitis B protecting us from? Or say more about that.
Well, many people have probably seen the commercials on TV about hepatitis C and some of the new medications that they're using to treat that. Hepatitis B is a similar virus. It's just found in a little bit different. So there's hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C. hepatitis B, when what we're really seeing an increase from is the fact that we've heard about the opioid crisis in New Jersey and kind of in the northeastern part of the United States and really throughout. And what we're finding is that because of the opioid crisis and cross-contamination with IV drug use and needles, that more mothers are giving hepatitis B to their babies. And so anything we can do to avoid that risk or to get that baby vaccinated early on, that's going to decrease the risk of hepatitis B for those neonates.
Now, speaking of mothers passing on to their preborn children, we had a conversation a little bit earlier today, just wondering about alcohol. I know that you're working in a area just in terms of some addiction areas, but are you finding fetal alcohol? Is that still an issue and a concern?
Very much so. And, you know, I've got a sign on my desk talking about what are, you know, supposedly safe, low-risk drinking limits. And for men and women, it differs. For ages greater than 65, it differs. But for pregnancy, it's zero. There's really no safe amount of alcohol for a pregnant woman to have that that we know will not affect her fetus. And so we really recommend abstinence during pregnancy.
You know, saw a new study indicating that there are concerns about hypertension among children, which seemed maybe a little surprising. What does that say, I guess, about our culture, and what are some of the factors causing? And maybe we need to explain what hypertension is.
Well, hypertension, which is known as high blood pressure, and we often have thought of that as an adult disease, but what's happened is that the American Academy of Pediatrics has developed things, and they've included an updated diagnosis table so that it's based on the diagnosis of hypertension is based on the child's normal weight range and their height. It's not just what their actual weight is now. And the reason we're looking at that is the fact that we're really struggling with obesity and overweight in our pediatric population, and these children are getting adult diseases. We're seeing more diabetes, we're seeing insulin resistance, and certainly the hypertension as well. And, you know, parents should understand that hypertension only occurs in 2 to 5% of all pediatric patients, but it's still within the top 5 chronic conditions for the under 18 set. So, you know, this is a big issue. Variety of factors are at work, including obesity and family history. So when your child goes for their well-child checkup and you're used to getting height and weight and vaccinations, we also want to remind parents, be asking for that blood pressure screen as well.
Okay. And are those, I mean, it's a top concern, but is it, I guess, easily treatable? And is sort of diet and lifestyle enough to change that, at least as a preteen or a teen?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm really cautious about using the word diet with my teenagers because I really want them to know that this is about their health and not about their body image or about cultural pressures, particularly that our young women are facing. But this is about their health. And so we tell them, you know, we just want your weight to stay the same or we want it to go down a little bit depending on what they're facing. But really it's about exercise, about decreasing the screen time and increasing the active time.
I also noted that depression among children is a growing concern as well. Say a bit more about that area.
We are finding that, you know, depressive disorders, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, and even post-traumatic stress disorder are, you know, the most common diagnoses among children. And there are medications that can help them, and different studies have continued to show that. Certainly the SSRI class, some people might be familiar with Prozac or Paxil, Zoloft. These are some of the mainstays of the SSRI class, the serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Those are safe for children in certain circumstances, but how good they do or how much they help the child is going to depend on the condition. One thing that the authors noted in this study is that it makes sense to start with the psychotherapy unless there's a preference for medication. And that is, we want to teach children not just to take a medicine when they're struggling, you know, with a mood disorder, whether it's depression, feeling hopeless, not sleeping well, not eating well. We also want to teach them good coping skills. And, you know, there's lots of talk about bullying and how children can be treated badly by another, you know, child on the playground or at school. And that is extremely stressful. And we do need to be aware of that and to deal with that in healthy ways and not just look to a medication, but look to our faith as well as good coping skills. And those are best taught with psychotherapy.
Dr. Julie Stewart is my guest today. Our phone lines are open at 877-933-2484, or you can submit your question online as well at myfaithradio.com. And click on the Connecting Faith show page. There's an email tab there. You can send your question right into the studio that way. Talking health today and good health practices. April in Fargo asks the question, says, can you speak to the use of vitamins? As someone I know said that they give their kids vitamins and they don't get sick as often, but it's my understanding that there are other factors involved, that the vitamins need to be paired with something else in order to work effectively. What are your thoughts on that?
Vitamins are a good idea, and the American Academy of Pediatrics does recommend giving vitamins, maybe a multivitamin, to your children. I would be very cautious because some vitamins, such as A and D, can actually get backed up in the system because they're stored in our fat cells and not just excreted in the urine like vitamin C is. And so you want to make sure you're giving the recommended daily allowance, the RDA, for your child based on his or her age or weight. But I think for, you know, especially those picky toddlers, as we're trying to teach them about new foods on days that they're not eating as well, it can make some parents feel better that they, you know, were able to get the nutrients into their kids when they turn down the green beans because they're having a power struggle at 2 years old, to know that they still got their multivitamin that day. But really, there's no replacement for healthy eating. And I would caution parents about relying on vitamins as a means to prevent or fully treat an illness. That needs to, again, be taken in balance with the rest of a healthy lifestyle and also with other measures that we can do. And I go back to the good hand hygiene or hand washing and teaching the kids to cover and cough as ways to prevent the spread of illnesses.
And any strategies for the 2-year-old and the green beans?
Well, oh,
just
if there were. Many a parent has looked. You know, one of the things that we're trying to do is do mixes. So when we're teaching our infants to eat, you know, we used to say that rice cereal or some of the cereals were their first foods. Really, we pureed avocado is a great way to start, get the babies on that. I know with Corbin, our son, we've done lots of mixes. So we actually give pureed squash with pureed apple, and we mix that together. We give pureed sweet potato mixed with a mango. And we do peas and pears. And so green beans alone he won't eat, but we do give him some pears with those. And just kind of getting him used to those different flavors. And then the further they go, they're able to separate those out and tolerate them a little bit better.
Good word. All right.
Those mixes. If it sounds good to you, if chicken and peaches, you know, on the grill sounds good to you, it probably will sound good to your 6-month-old.
Dr. Julie Stewart, pediatrician, with us today. We're talking health and taking your calls. 877-933-2484 is the phone number, 877-93-FAITH. We'll talk more. We'll get to healthy snacks and all that coming up in a moment.
Doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case loving you.
Okay. It's Ask the Doctor today. I'm not going to ask about, love advice. But anyway, Dr. Julie Stewart is with us. Glad to have her back on. She's part of the Christian Medical and Dental Association and actually practices at Community Health Center in Southeast Kansas, in Pittsburgh, Kansas. And we always appreciate the opportunity to just get great health, good health and medical advice. And so we're doing that today, and the phone lines are open. If you'd like to join in or you want to submit a question online, you can do that as well. If you go to myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page, you can use the email link there. Talking a little bit before the break about, you know, food mixes and kind of ways to get our kids to try some different things and get accustomed to that. I want to talk a little bit about snacks, Julie, because and we want to have healthy snacks. A lot of advertising emphasizing healthy, quote-unquote, or organic or whatever. So are there some recommendations about how do we help our kids eat right between meals?
Well, you know, a good way for parents to think about the diet for their children and overall nutrition is offering the right foods at the right times. So we do know that snacks can keep the younger children from getting hungry, especially when it's, you know, still 30 minutes before dinner and they're really hungry. That's a good time for, you know, an apple or a half a banana, not the cupcake. So we do know that they, you know, want little rewards and want to be able to enjoy birthday cake on certain occasions. But really we want them to focus on healthy snacks such as yogurt, lean proteins, including yogurt and milk, apples with peanut butter, that kind of thing, more so than the bags of chips or cookies and crackers that they can get.
Because those pretty much are all what they all turn to sugar anyway, don't they?
They do, and the way that God made our foods is that in fruits and vegetables is it pairs the carbohydrate or the sugar along with the fiber that slows the digestion so that it doesn't spike our blood sugars. And certainly when we pair the apples with peanut butter and that healthy fat along with the fiber from the apple, that will keep the kids fuller for longer and also gets them the healthy vitamins and minerals that they need to grow.
Now, we hear sometimes that, you know, as adults, we should be maybe eating smaller meals more often. Is that the case with kids as well, that it's okay to be, you know, snacking throughout the day?
We'd rather them not snack or graze all day long because then the kids don't figure out when they're truly hungry. And one of the keys to maintaining a healthy weight in childhood is to know I'm hungry, I need to eat a certain portion. And teaching them good portion control as they grow is healthier than just letting them snack all through the day, even if it's healthy snacking. So keeping that breakfast, lunch, and dinner, maybe a snack when they get home from school and kind of need a break in the day, or if they want a bedtime snack, that's okay too. Just, again, wanting to make sure it's a lean protein or a healthy fruit or vegetable.
So oftentimes, you know, we might want to suggest snacking with some almonds or something like that, but it seems like there's a lot of restrictions now for schools. You can't, you know, no nuts for peanut allergies and things. Are you seeing more allergies, and would something like almonds, or are there some other snacks like that would be good substitutes?
Yes, you would want to talk with your particular school about that in terms of what they're allowed to have. But low-fat string cheese is a good idea, nuts and raisins, if those are allowed. Whole grain pretzels, fruit slices dipped in low-fat flavored yogurt is another idea for the kids. So there's lots of things out there. We just have to be creative as parents and again, abide by school policies, since we do know that there are some kids with severe Trina allergies that can cause anaphylaxis and ultimately lead to their death if not dealt with in a timely situation.
Are we seeing more food allergies than we used to?
You know, I think we're diagnosing more just because of availability and about the advancements of medicines. And so certainly that can make it feel like we're diagnosing them more. But when it comes down to it, the numbers, I don't know that they're necessarily increased as much as our awareness is. And we're, again, as the medical community, responsible to get that information out and into the hands of parents.
Well, speaking of awareness, we're becoming more aware about brain development, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about, you know, it's not necessarily a medical question, I guess, but if we're using screen as to babysit, quote-unquote, our young children, how is that impacting their brains, and do you have some recommendations there?
Well, you know, speaking as a parent myself, I can certainly say that putting your baby in front of a TV screen, just 5 minutes to yourself can do wonders for your own mental health, I would say. That being said, we have actually chosen in our family to not own a television, and so our baby is not exposed to screen time. So that's something that we feel very passionately about, though I do empathize with parents because there are days I wish I had a TV. But, you know, there are lots of currents relating to television and children, because time spent watching TV displaces other types of creative and imaginative activities. They're not up around using their imagination. It, you know, television or screen time, it discourages reading, it discourages exercise, because watching something is easier than using your imagination. It's easier than being up and moving around. The advertising that the kids are exposed to increases the demand for material possessions, you know, and lastly, but very importantly, exposure to violence on TV can actually increase aggressive behavior in some children. They're not learning that, you know, the natural consequences of their behaviors. They're not learning the social skills that they need to be. So we really want to limit that screen time to 30 minutes a day.
When you see patients, are you finding you're spending maybe more time dealing with some social issues than actual physical medical things? I mean, has it kind of changed in your role?
Absolutely. And that goes back to the holistic care and our philosophy here at Community Health Center. We actually have a behavioral health consultant. And what that is a licensed therapist that when I do a well-child checkup, I can visit with the parents about, you know, maybe the height, the weight, the blood pressure, the nutrition elements. But we also have a therapist that can come in the room and make sure, particularly with those pre-teenagers and younger, kind of screen for bullying, for school readiness, if there's any school avoidance, like, you know, missing multiple absences for ill-defined reasons, such as, you know, stomach pain or a sore throat, when there's not really a defined illness there, we can have her visit with the child or the preteen as well as the family and see if there's something deeper, because we do know that children are struggling with depression and anxiety, and, you know, we as adults live in a stressful environment, but sometimes we can inadvertently push those stresses in the home onto our children, not to mention what they have to deal with on the playground as well. So, again, holistic care, find a physician or a provider that's going to really give that to your child and to your family, because it's very important to look at their social growth as well as it is to look at their physical growth.
I know you worked with Global Health Outreach in Honduras before entering medical school. I mean, it's probably some stark differences in many cases as you see, you know, patients in Kansas compared to maybe, you know, the kinds of experiences you had in a place like Honduras.
There are some very different illnesses that they face in terms of the chronic illnesses. But, you know, global research is showing us that even in missionary medicine, that chronic disease management is what the impoverished nations are needing. It's not just treating, you know, the worms or the malnutrition of the kids that it used to be. Globally, we're seeing rises in diabetes and hypertension and heart disease and that kind of thing. So, you know, for as different as we are, there are still some of those cultural norms are changing across the globe, and we're still having to deal with those in medicine as well.
You know, we do hear often, of course, about the spread of serious diseases because we're so much more mobile and things get around so much, and diseases seem like they're maybe advancing, even though, you know, there's a lot of advances in medicine. Are there, you know, ways that we can actually, you know, protect ourselves from those, you know, potential pandemics, or is that just a lot of maybe, you know, news concern?
You know, it depends on what the actual illness would be, you know, and certainly we've seen some of those pandemics over with Ebola and those different crises. I go back to good hand washing, good hand hygiene, and making sure that we're protecting ourselves from that way. We don't have to live in fear. You know, God has called us to abundant life and not to a life of fear. And he's also called us to be responsible with our bodies as, you know, as his temple. And so we want to treat those well. We want to, you know, the best immune activator you can have is a healthy diet and a healthy exercise amount. And so going back to those and just simple hand washing, you know, as Ecclesiastes says, there's really nothing new under the sun. It's just a matter of implementing what we've been told to.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation in a moment. We got another segment with Dr. Julie Stewart. We'd love to have you join the conversation. If you have a question or just a health concern, the phone lines are open. It's Ask the Doctor today. Dr. Julie Stewart is certified in internal medicine and pediatrics and works at Community Health Center in Southeast Kansas, Pittsburgh, Kansas, part of Christian Medical and Dental Association. Give you some wise advice today. By the way, you have kids, questions about child health. She just said that kidshealth.org is a good website, reputable website, where they refer questions. So let me just write that down if you have some ongoing concerns or just something you're looking for, a quick reference, kidshealth.org. More with Dr. Julie Stewart here in just a moment on Connecting Faith. Talking good health today on Connecting Faith. Glad to have Dr. Julie Stewart back with us. She's part of Christian Medical and Dental Association, practicing at the Community Health Center in Southeast Kansas in Pittsburgh, Kansas. She also is medical director of the Addiction Treatment Service at Community Health Center and working with implementing medication-assisted therapy for patients dealing with addiction. And we're taking your questions today about health issues, not just maybe for your kids, but for you as well. One of the questions came in is, what are your thoughts about people not going to see the doctor? Maybe something's minor irritation, but not debilitating, a sore shoulder or leg or something that people are just going to live with. You know, do they, maybe they don't go because they don't, you know, have insurance or want to pay copay costs. Do you have any advice on how to decide when to go see you or one of your compatriots?
Boy, that is a tough question, and I certainly can understand the difficulty that some people have with access to care. You know, doing what I do, we have up to 50% of the patients that we see don't have insurance, and so we are considered a critical access clinic for those, both because of rural medicine and the lack of physicians and healthcare professionals that we have in our area, as well as the fact that we live in the poorest and least healthy region of Kansas. And so I see a lot of people with advanced pathology and disease processes that are much worse than they could have been had they been diagnosed early. And so what I would say is if something has been bothering you for more than a week or two, it's probably worth getting it checked out because, you know, even something as simple as a twinge in the shoulder, if it's, you know, calcified tendonitis, you're going to have a much harder time and need a lot more physical therapy to get that loosened up if you wait a month than if you had been seen after the first week or two that you really noticed that something was wrong. And, you know, medicine is a very individualized thing to the extent that each patient is going to feel pain differently and going to be able to tolerate a certain amount before they decide to seek help or have certain values that some people have full health insurance, but they just don't like the white coat and it kind of gets them revved up in their engines and nervous about bad news because, you know, maybe their mom had a bad experience when she died, and so they are very hesitant that even though it's something very serious and they have the funds for it, they don't go in. So it's a very individualized thing, but, you know, we know in our hearts when something is not improving or if it's worsening, and for those who don't have health insurance, I understand, you know, certainly where they're coming from. Look for a federally qualified health center or a community health center. You can Google that, look it up, and find one closest to you. And those clinics often will have a sliding scale for those who are underinsured or do not have insurance, and that can help them get that access to care that they really need.
And maybe just say more about that. A community health center, how is that different from a local, you know, physician's doctor's office?
community health center, we are a federally qualified health center, and what that means is that we do get money from the federal government to operate. We have about 20% of our operating expenses are federally funded. The 80% is what we get from our patients that pay a sliding fee scale for those that are uninsured or those that have commercial insurance or government-sponsored programs like Medicare or Medicaid. So we take everyone regardless of ability to pay. We accept all insurances and certainly those without insurance. Oftentimes, private physician offices will, because of the way that they have to make money and then, you know, fund the physician's salary, their nurses, their staff, they're not able to see as many uninsured patients, and that's why they're having to charge the higher prices than what community health centers can do with their sliding scale. Hospitals, again, whether it's a private hospital versus not-for-profit hospital, they're going to differ in the amount of charity care that, they are able to do. So medicine is a very complex thing. That's why we saw so much of it with President Obama and certainly now with President Trump looking to see what can be done with the difficulties and the rising healthcare costs that we're facing.
You know, you mentioned lack of physicians in rural areas. I mean, many of our listeners all across the upper Midwest or even Hartford are, you know, where there are less and less doctors available. Is that a trend that you see changing anytime soon?
Well, there is much research in terms of public health that's being done. What we know is that young physicians coming out of their residencies are most likely to plant closer to their residency. And so we're trying to, even at Community Health, we have a rural track program through the University of Kansas School of Medicine where we can have students come for their third and fourth years, their clinical years of medical school to train, hoping to show them the joys and, I would admit, the difficulties of practicing in a rural environment. You know, even this month working with me, I've got a medical student who has opened her mind to rural medicine and come out here to work and to see the work that we do. And so really educating people about the opportunity and also our needs. You know, we have debt repayment sponsorships both by the federal government and by the state of Kansas for physicians and advanced practice registered nurses or nurse practitioners, as they're commonly called, physician assistants, and even dentists, that we can help them with their loan repayment because we are a health provider shortage area.
But, of course, it'd be harder to have a horse in Kansas City than it is in Pittsburgh, Kansas, right?
It is. I, you know, it's funny. When I first joined, I grew up in a city and came to rural Kansas for the debt repayment and did what my CEO had always wanted, and that was to marry a cowboy and get landlocked. And so we've got a farm and the cattle and the row crops, and it would be a travesty for me to turn down Clementine, my little boy's pony, before he got to race in the 4-H races.
So. Oh, fun. That sounds great.
We're in it to win it.
Good.
In Kansas here.
Good for you. Dr. Julie Stewart's my guest there. Got a couple minutes left here. If you have a question, we'll try and squeeze it in at 877-933-2484. Talking health and wellness today, 877-93-FAITH. I'm curious, Julie, how do you as a doctor react to all the health news reports and the daily news? You know, there's a new finding every day. In fact, you know, a lot of you know, major networks have the health reporter, and so they're always looking for the headline. How should we pay attention to that? Maybe how do you pay attention to that?
Well, I would say as a physician, you know, part of medical school and residency, what they teach us is how to examine a journal article, how to examine the study and the way that it was done. You know, what are the potential biases that could have happened? What are things that weren't thought about that could explain the findings? And so that's what we do, you know, as health professionals, to distill out the information and the truths that we can keep. Certainly we're taught to look at the evidence and to examine the evidence. And, you know, that goes back to what Paul says in the Bible, to even test the spirits and to be wise about that. So that's what I do. I get emails in from different journals, and I know certain ones that are widely circulated and generally respected, you know, such as the American Academy of Pediatrics and their journal. We know that those are reputable, that those studies are large, that there's not the bias, there's not the pharmaceutical bias affecting it. And then there are certain other studies that, that you know, are perhaps less robust and maybe we need to take with a grain of salt. And I would just encourage people, go back to the basics, you know, just as we've talked so much about here in this hour, to go back to the basics of what you know, what you've learned in the Bible. There's nothing new under the sun. And even though we're learning things every day, when we go back to the basics, if it doesn't support what you already know in your heart to do and what the biblical evidence is telling you to do, then you really need to rethink it and investigate more before you fully implement that study finding into your life.
Good word. Chris in Maple Grove wanted to know, is it too early to start getting the flu shot? I know that, you know, they are available now, but do we want to sort of wait, or what do you recommend?
They say that it takes about 6 weeks to get full immunity from, you know, to have your immune system be fully ready, and it should last you through the season. So, no, I wouldn't say it's too early. I would go ahead and be looking for it. You know, I have an October birthday, and so one of the kind of silly things that I do is I always get my flu shot on my birthday. I know it's going to get me through the flu season. And I also know that I'm going to have enough immunity to really take good care of our patients once the flu really comes around. So that's just kind of a kooky way that I do to remember. But I would just pick a day in the fall that you're comfortable with, and that way you'll know every year by that date, that's when I need to have my flu vaccine for me and my family.
Your husband must love it that you don't. It doesn't cost a lot for him to get your birthday present.
No. Nope, just a ride to the doctor's office.
What is the? Is there a most frequently asked question, or maybe a reason that someone comes to see you? Is there something that just rises to the top year in and year out, or maybe if it's changed?
You know, I do so much addiction medicine right now. It's a lot of it is how did I get here and how do I get out of it? And as I think of the different, you know, situations that people find themselves in, that really is generally, you know, even chronic medicine is, why do I have heart disease? Why do I have diabetes? And how do I get to a place of health so that I am controlling my life and making the decisions about what I want to do instead of the disease process controlling me? And so that just presents itself in many various forms throughout my day.
Well, we want to ask those questions earlier than later and work through the answers, getting some great advice as always. Dr. Julie Stewart with us today, pediatrician practicing in the Community Health Center in Southeast Kansas, Pittsburgh, Kansas. And again, you mentioned the kidshealth.org as a website that might be helpful for parents to have some questions for their kids.
Absolutely. And yeah. www.chcsek.org is our website as well.
Okay. Julie, good to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming back with us here on Connecting Faith. Have a great week.
Thank you, Neil, and thank you to your listeners.
Prayer. According to Cesar Rodriguez, it should be the foundation of everything. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count, and Cesar says daily communication with God makes a huge difference in his faith journey.
Prayer is key. If one is thinking that they could do any aspect of ministry without prayer, they're falsely mistaken. Prayer and fasting is key.
For one young man, his concern for his sister's cancer diagnosis compelled him to pray fervently for her healing.
He was volunteering, but his mind wasn't there. He was agonized and worried about his sister's health. She had cancer. So we corporately and privately would pray. We prayed about a month, 2 months, and we got a praise report that she was cancer-free. Doctors couldn't find anything in her.
Sometimes we actually see God do amazing things through prayer. To share how you've seen God work through prayer in your life, go to MakingYourLifeCount.com.
If you missed part of the conversation today, want to maybe pass it on to a friend, our guest, Dr. Julie Stewart, you can go to ConnectingFaith.com. show page at myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. We're talking about disease and resistance, all that today. Tomorrow we're going to talk about becoming resilient. Joe Bender talks to Donna Gibbs about becoming resilient, moving how to move through suffering and come back stronger. More on that tomorrow on Connecting Faith. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.